You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's a continuation of this month's cover story, Real Talk by Julie Miller, with photographs by Emma Summerton, styled by Leith Clark. Wild is careful about what she says about her relationship with Stiles. I think once you crack open the window, as she puts it, you can't then be mad when mosquitoes come in. It's like you opened the window. Still, his effect on her life is clear between the lines of what she does say. She tells me about watching him play a 21,000-person arena. Standing next to her was Jenny Lewis, the indie rock icon who had opened the show. We were looking around, and she said, "That's a lot of happy women," Wilde remembers, noting that, of course, there were many men in the arena, too. I instantly started crying. Where else do we see this? Happy women. Women brought together with joy, loving each other, and cheering for each other. This has been like a gift to be amongst this. Wilde makes a point of saying that Styles' fans have welcomed her with open arms. His fans are a beautiful and loving group of people. I have had the opportunity to witness some of the most moving examples of compassion and acceptance. Standing in a room with 20,000 happy women, that's... She fishes for the appropriate words, but can't find them. Would Wilde consider marrying again? The short answer is yes. She's always looked to her parents as a model for a healthy partnership. It's incredibly supportive, and they've evolved individually and as a couple through so many unexpected twists and turns. They're best friends, and I think that's what marriage really is. It's a commitment to a best friendship and a partnership. I think now I really understand what that means. Wilde stands by advice that she got from a mall Santa Claus about a decade ago. She and her friend had gotten in line at the Grove in L.A. as a joke, but Santa actually blew their minds with his sage wisdom. Santa said, "Fill up your own love cup. Let someone fall in love with your overflow." Even though it comes from this ludicrous source, I have told so many people, you've just got to fill up your own love cup. Thousands of dollars of therapy did not give us what 5 minutes of mall Santa did. Internet gossips will no doubt be relieved to hear that Wilde's priority continues to be her children. "I love driving to school every morning," she says. "I love making pancakes. I love putting them to bed every night. They're my best friends. There's nothing that is more important to me." She credits her kids with giving her strength in the face of public scrutiny. We almost find more strength in protecting others than protecting ourselves. I think that I am able to understand all of the nonsense because I'm protecting them. Wilde is readying to direct a handful of movies, a feature documentary, her first, about the legendary Los Angeles roller skating rink, Flipper's Roller Boogie Palace. A secret Marvel project. A movie about the Olympian Carrie Strug and the fraught world of gymnastics. She doesn't currently have plans to act again, though that could change with the right script. She's always been troubled by the idea that actresses are supposed to quietly die at the age of 40. "How is it that the more experience I have, the less valuable I am?" she says. "Because as an actress, the older you get, the less opportunities you have. With directing, the more experience you have, the more valuable you are. You want to be Agnès Varda. You want people to think, oh, by the time you're 80, you'll be so good." the court of King James, at home with LeBron and his family, where star power runneth over. Photographs by Gillian Laub, styled by Matthew Henson. Article by Dan Adler. Opening photos, LeBron James and Savannah James with their children, Bronny, Bryce, and Zuri. They look like the 2023 Rockefellers, says LeBron's mother. LeBron and Savannah with their Porsche 918 Spyder. Bronny's, Bryce's, and LeBron's clothing are by Gucci, along with Zuri's dress and Savannah's gown. James, LeBron James, and Savannah Brinson met in 2002 when they were students at nearby high schools in Ohio, and just as LeBron became a national phenomenon, the promise of his early expectations was staggering, but he went on to outstrip it. At 37, he's not so much an elder statesman of the NBA as he is the engine of its contemporary business, politics, and presentation. He's also vocal about being a family man. He and Savannah married in 2013, and they have three children, Bronny, Bryce, and Zuri. As LeBron prepares to enter his 20th season as a standard bearer for the NBA and its ever-growing cultural footprint, his family has assumed increasingly prominent roles in the landscape he has reshaped. Vanity Fair joined them as they gathered at their Los Angeles home to commemorate in their first photo shoot as a family, including Savannah's parents, Jennifer and JK, and LeBron's mother, Gloria, what Savannah described to me as a transitional moment for her children. For Bronny, who turns 18 in October, a guard for the high school powerhouse basketball team at Sierra Canyon, it's about getting to a place to start to make decisions about his career and where he wants to go in his life. Zuri, a precocious 7, has her own successful YouTube lifestyle show, All Things Zuri. Highlights have included segments on baking, yoga, and painting. Bryce, 15, Savannah lovingly calls the mystery of the family, insofar as he could go in any direction, though he's also a much-hyped basketball prospect himself. At Sierra Canyon Games, the celebrities are both on the court and in the crowd, and Savannah has observed her children growing into the dynamic. With LeBron being their dad, it's just automatic, she said. It's not something we've pushed or told them that they had to do or anything like that. It just happened. LeBron signed with the Los Angeles Lakers in 2018, and his arrival in the city marked a culmination of how both he and the broader world of professional sports had grown entangled with the entertainment business. Some of the most resonant phrases of his career have to do with the place of an athlete, particularly a black athlete in society, more than an athlete, or his refutations of Fox News host Laura Ingraham's insistence that he shut up and dribble. They look like the 2023 Rockefellers, Gloria said as she surveyed the dinner table. She has a point. While the James family has not pursued anything like Kardashian levels of on-screen confessional, Zuri's comfort with an audience and the breathless anticipation around her brother's careers have meant that the family has similarly established itself as a public institution. In their Los Angeles garage, a photoshopped image of Bronny guarding a high school-aged LeBron hangs on the wall. LeBron has said he intends for the two of them to play together in the NBA, and the basketball internet ecosystem has recently turned its lens on a photo of LeBron and Bryce that seemed to show their heights converging. Watch your head, Mama, LeBron said earlier as he tossed a basketball over his shoulder and toward the hoop. In between photographs, he and his sons had been holding a semi-competitive dunk contest on a shortened hoop in the driveway while Zuri chased a lizard. During LeBron's second season with the Miami Heat that began in 2011, He proposed to Savannah on New Year's Eve, and her parents moved into their house. Their relationship has lasted 20 years and endured no small amount of scrutiny, but at the bottom of their driveway, it looked easy and spontaneous. As they posed in front of a Porsche, LeBron whispered into Savannah's ear, and she doubled over laughing. "I cannot repeat that." Today, Savannah hopes to communicate an image of the family's quiet dynamic at home. "Everything isn't for everybody," she said, but she wanted this photo session to recognize and reflect the bonds underlying the family's influence, to show the world their center of gravity. "Excuse my language," she said, "but we a dope family." Next photos, artist in residence. Zuri, the wise beyond her years host of a successful show on YouTube, sketches her brothers, Bronny and Bryce. And all in the family, Savannah's parents, Jennifer and J.K. Brinson, Bronny, Savannah, Zuri, LeBron, Bryce, and LeBron's mother, Gloria. After such knowledge, what forgiveness? Reporting from Ukraine, veteran war correspondent Janine DiGiovanni describes an urgent campaign to collect evidence of Russian war crimes that might stand up in court against Putin, his commanders, and their troops. With photographs by Larry Towell. Opening photo, high crimes. With no electricity, in Bucha's morgues, a cemetery holds corpses exhumed from mass graves. I am an academic and a writer. I am a human rights advisor. I am a mother. But at heart, I am a war reporter. I have covered some 18 wars over the past 35 years. On a brittle February morning, preparing for a class I was teaching at Yale, which dissected four murderous conflicts in Bosnia, Rwanda, Kosovo, and Sierra Leone, I first heard the news of Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine. I know Putin's tactics of war very well, so I knew I had to find my way to Ukraine and begin documenting atrocities. But I wanted to go with a different mission than my usual beat as a reporter. I felt I needed to be working at the center of the war crimes investigations that would inevitably be mobilized. But first, I need to tell you about Teta and the Red Tulips. Red Tulips. It never gets easier. You sit in a broken house, in an overgrown field, or at a shattered kitchen table. You sit with someone's wife, or parent, or sister, brother, friend. You listen to how the person they loved was dragged off, how they never came home. The person recounting the story tells you about the day their whole life ended, when their loved one was taken away. You listen. You watch the speaker intensely. They are still alive. Their bodies still move. They eat, drink, walk. But their grief has frozen them in an anguish so palpable they seem more dead than alive. Teta, whose name I have changed to protect her identity, is standing outside her destroyed house in Bucha, where in February and March, battles took place between Ukrainian and Russian forces. She is 55, but looks a decade older. She wears a ripped green sweater, track pants, a yellow-patterned headscarf. She alternately smokes, paces, cries, wipes her eyes, laughs, or shouts something in Russian, the language of many Bucha residents, to neighborhood boys who are helping her granddaughter rebuild the home that was destroyed by a missile. They work silently. They ignore me, the stranger with the notebook, from another country. Teta, like me, is a mother. But my son is alive. Her son, Andriy, 36, disappeared shortly after Russian troops came to Bucha and was later found dead. I heard about Teta's son from people who live on the other side of her garden. A boy disappeared, one neighbor told me. The soldiers had done terrible things. The photo of Andriy after the soldiers took him showed more than terrible things. I have sorted through hundreds of photos of Syrians tortured during the ongoing war there. Still, I could not look at Andriy's photo without gagging. His eyes were gouged out. His teeth were knocked clean from his jaw. A metal skewer inserted through his right eye had pushed through to the other side of his left ear. Why? Teta asked. But of course, there is no answer. No words of consolation for this kind of cruelty. Later, I found a photo of a younger Andriy stuck in the corner of a mirror. He once was a handsome man with an open, clean face, blondish curls. Teta told me about how the columns of soldiers swept into the town, shooting, and then forcing most of the people into their cellars. How her sister, who was 53 and epileptic, died while Teta and others cowered underground. how they lived with her corpse for days, begging soldiers to allow them to bury her. How the soldiers, even as the family dug up the frozen earth to bury Tata's sister, told Tata she should be grateful they had come to save the townspeople from what they absurdly referred to as Ukrainian Nazis. In Bucha, it was the beginning of spring. The cherry blossoms fell on the road like white stars. Tulips, red as blood, lined the gardens. Most homes, even those where Russian tanks had driven straight through the flower beds, were adorned with rows of tulips in vivid colors, red, yellow, white. Flowers were bursting throughout Bucha. I heard birdsong. In another world, another time, it was peaceful here. Echoes of death, signs of life. Years ago, this small city was a summer place where people from Kyiv had dachas. Today, the road to Bucha is a wartime road. You drive out of Kyiv, passing the closed-down Antonov plane factory, then rusty tank traps and sandbags. You come to Irpin, where the blown-up bridge where civilians struggled to cross under sniper and tank fire. You see destroyed railroad stations. Then you arrive. Bucha became a commuter town, where those who couldn't afford city prices built Soviet-style apartment blocks and small, pretty pastel houses with neat square gardens and iron gates. Now this is a place that stinks of death. Evil things happened here. According to Amnesty International, those things included torture, extrajudicial killings, murders without lawful authority, indiscriminate shelling of homes. For weeks, bodies lay on the road, in basements, in fields, in mass graves. In the cemetery, I sat under a spreading linden tree talking to Vladislav Minchenko, a volunteer grave digger, who told me how after the Russians left, they first put the hundreds of bodies in a common grave behind the main church, St. Andrew, with its giant gold dome. Then we kept finding more bodies, he said, so we started bringing them here. Many had yet to be identified. Someone in Bucha told me that when they went to collect the corpses, in apartments, next to wells, in the streets, there weren't enough body bags, so they used black garbage bin liners. Still, life returns, even to the most haunted of places. And it is returning to Bucha in slow motion. After all, life must return after war. Bosnian schools opened in Srebrenica after the 1995 genocide. In Rwanda, where more than 800,000 civilians, primarily Tutsis, were slaughtered in the spring of 1994, farms were replenished and soon grew coffee and corn, even after so much blood was spilled on that same earth. A little more than a month after the Russians retreated, the cleaning of Bucha had begun. People were returning to the shattered pastel houses, where flowers were bursting over the front gates. The supermarket was full of people carrying baskets of produce, milk, and cheese. I didn't encounter many smiles or interactions. People hurried through the aisles and somberly glanced at one another or nodded with an air of, "You made it too." Cafes were opening. Internet service was about to be restored. At St. Andrew, Father Andrew welcomed visiting European parliamentarians who had come to see images of the crimes. University of Michigan professor of sociology Genevieve Zubrisky, who directs the Weiser Center for Europe and Eurasia, told me that similar to how Auschwitz has become a shorthand for the horrors of the Holocaust, years from now, Bucha will be evoked as a symbol for the Ukrainian war. Father Andrew pulled out a video on his phone from February 26th. It showed smoke rising over his church in the early days of the war. "Before what we knew would happen," he said, "we talked about God and free will, about how the Russian Orthodox Church sanctioned Putin's killing spree." It's hard to understand how Kirill, the Patriarch of Moscow, can authorize this. If he was a real patriarch, he would talk like a father with kids. He didn't see the people of Bucha as people. He saw us as a territory to conquer. By Father Andrew's count, 412 people died in Bucha, but that number is still being revised. They killed randomly, people trying to buy food or drive their car. He leads me behind the church to a lump of freshly dug dark brown earth where he says around 30 people were recently buried. "It's man's choice to do evil or not," he says. "We can easily switch from evil to good. It's not God who is doing the killing." I thought of what Teta had said when I hugged her goodbye, her wet cheek against my sweater. She had asked me in a whisper, "Can you imagine the unspeakable pain of losing your child? Now imagine him mutilated. In every house in this town, someone was killed." I kept thinking of a line from a T.S. Eliot poem, "After such knowledge, what forgiveness?" The Reckoning Project. The phone call came on February 25th, the day after Russian troops advanced into Ukraine. On the line was the British writer and academic Peter Pomerantsev, a senior fellow at the Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins. Pomerantsev is regarded as an authority on Russian propaganda. He was born in Kyiv to Russian dissident parents, and since 2014 has been closely engaged with some of the country's leading authors, journalists, intellectuals, and politicians. Pomerantsev's voice was anguished. He was not content, he said, with reading about Ukraine in press accounts, or even going to report the war. "What can we do?" he said, distraught. I told him I had just finished a project and had a template for an initiative I had run for the UN Democracy Fund in Yemen, Syria, and Iraq. For those initiatives, my team and I had trained local journalists to meticulously gather evidence of war crimes in very specific ways. More on this later. So that eyewitness testimony could eventually be used in international tribunals. Given the speed, variety, and level of atrocities that seem to be in store for Ukraine, I suggested that documenting them in real time might be a way to harness international justice. I proposed joining forces and applying the template to this conflict. In my years as a correspondent, I have covered three genocides in Srebrenica, Rwanda, and the slaughter of the Yazidi in Iraq. But several years ago, I discovered that all of my piles of reporting, my rows and rows of carefully labeled Moleskine notebooks, did not adhere to strict legal standards. When I was called by The Hague to give accounts of crimes I had witnessed in Bosnia or Sierra Leone or Kosovo, my memory was foggy, my notebooks disorganized. Frustrated by my inability to use my reporting as evidence, I realized I had a major gap in my education. For a lifetime, I had been studying human nature during wartime, but I did not know how the legal system could be used to stop wars or bring justice. So in 2015, I went to the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy as a PACIS fellow and studied international law and international relations, receiving another degree. In the years that followed, with help from the UN and the Soufan Center, I started working in Syria, Yemen, and Iraq with colleagues Nicole Tung, Lila Jacinto, and others, training journalists to become documentarians reporting war crimes, making sure that certain factors didn't color their subjects' accounts, such as witnesses' trauma, the presence of local troops or militias at the time of an incident, and other potential biases. My theory from the start had been that along with first responders, paramedics, firefighters, police, and aid workers, journalists have access to information that can subsequently prove crucial in courtrooms. Journalists speak to all parties, victims or eyewitnesses who observed the horrors, first responders, refugees who have fled war zones, and the combatants themselves. After investigators arrive from the UN or the International Criminal Court, it can take years for their cases to get to trial. Take 1990s Bosnia, for example. Out of that conflict, 162 people would be indicted in the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, yet only 91 were ever sentenced. In the time between the end of the war and reconstruction, survivors saw no justice, no closure, no post-conflict resolution. Meanwhile, war criminals had time to escape. Radovan Karadzic, dubbed the Butcher of Bosnia, was able to take on a new identity as a mad New Age healer before his arrest in 2008. And the real perpetrator of the terrors of that war, Serbia's President Slobodan Milosevic, though finally hauled to The Hague in 2001 in his bedroom slippers, died before he could be convicted. When you think that an estimated 20,000 to 40,000 women were raped in Bosnia, and that 8,000 men and boys were killed or went missing in Srebrenica alone, 91 convictions is an appallingly low number. Starting with the war in Syria, those of us working to document war crimes got more sophisticated. We began to use different methods, like the brilliant work of the former British blogger Elliot Higgins Bellingcat. An investigative collective that specializes in fact-checking and open-source intelligence. In Syria, many people had smartphones. It was easy to photograph the impact of Putin's bombs or record the chevrons on the uniforms of Assad's soldiers who had abducted people. In that war, verifiable corroborative evidence, GPS data, digital tags, satellite images were recorded quickly, seamlessly, electronically. For those like Susan Micellis, the magnum photojournalist who covered wars in Latin America and went on to win a MacArthur, in part for her work in Kurdistan, what is important is that we work on war crimes while the conflict is still raging. This is a first, she says, of Ukraine, where we are voluminously recording war crimes while the war is still happening. The Reckoning Project was born the day Pomerantsev phoned me. It grew out of my deep frustration and a deep-rooted shame and sorrow that came from witnessing too many atrocities. I have never really gotten over the rows and rows of graves of men and boys in Srebrenica, or their mothers and wives telling me how they were pulled from their arms before they were murdered, or the dead bodies melting in the sun in Rwanda on a hot summer day during the genocide, or the agony of those in South Sudan, East Timor, Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen. Within a short time, we were able to get a commitment from the U.S. government to support an effort which I spearheaded along with Pomerantsev and Natalia Gumenyuk, a Ukrainian conflict reporter who has been covering military upheaval internationally for 2 decades, supported by legal and archival experts. Gumenyuk located 15 researchers and documentarians from across Ukraine and brought them together in Kyiv for training with Raji Abdul Salam, a Syrian Palestinian who was a key player in our efforts to take testimony in Syria. Some of our researchers came from occupied territories, Luhansk, Donetsk, others from cities like Kherson, the first to be captured, or places where horrific crimes happened, such as Sumy, Chernihiv, Kharkiv. Several had been victimized. One told me he was taken captive by Russian soldiers for 8 days, during which he was beaten, starved, and humiliated. His only crime, he had been a witness to Russian crimes. Our team takes testimony of war crimes and crimes against humanity, the bombing of hospitals, the crushed theater in Mariupol, extrajudicial killings, executions. They are exceedingly brave, documenting war crimes in their own country during a war. When I asked a group of them early on if they had the stomach for this, they looked at me in a startled way. "These are my people," one told me, almost indignantly. "These are my neighbors. There is no choice. This is what we have to do." Next photo, the wasteland. A devastated neighborhood in Irpin, on the road from Kyiv to Bucha. The genesis of genocide. First, you encounter an individual case. Next, you see similar cases stretched across a town, then a region, then a country. In time, you begin to see patterns in the atrocities, and you start to understand that the intent had been to deliberately erase a population and destroy its identity. This is the basis of war crimes tribunals for genocide, and genocide is a term that emerged in 1944 from a man who was educated in Lviv, of all places, which is now part of western Ukraine. The word was coined by a Jewish lawyer, Raphael Lemkin, a legal advisor to the U.S. chief prosecutor at Nuremberg. Lemkin combined the Greek word genos, race, people, with the Latin side, killing, in an attempt to articulate and understand the Nazi mass killings. The question of whether this war constitutes a genocide will be decided in the months and years to come. But history isn't waiting this time. Irina Venediktova, who recently, until recently, was the Ukrainian prosecutor general, decided to prosecute war crimes while the battlefields were still smoldering. So far, her team has a staggering list of 13,000 crimes it contends may have been committed by Russia. There are an estimated 25,000 such cases being examined by myriad agencies from around the world. Venediktova and her cohorts believe that justice is more likely to be served while the evidence is fresh, while the perpetrators are still on Ukrainian soil. On a hot morning in Kyiv in early May, I met with Venediktova, who 2 months later would be on the outs with President Zelensky, who called for her dismissal, along with that of Ukraine's intelligence chief. Zelensky alleged that people on their staffs were working against our state through collaboration with Russia. I was accompanied by Pomerantsev and Wayne Jordash, a British war crimes lawyer who advises the Reckoning Project, as he has the governments of Libya and Vietnam. Venediktova is a former constitutional law professor. Like her former boss, she dressed in quasi-combat gear, tailored camouflage trousers, a fitted forest green T-shirt. She has straight dark hair, piercing blue eyes, and a firm handshake. In a room full of men, she projected gravitas. "This is my purpose," she has remarked. To make Putin and his forces pay for what they have done. Venediktova told me that even as foreign investigators are working in Ukraine and international courts, await the evidence of their probes, the largest number of prosecutions will be conducted in Ukraine itself. In May, in fact, her agency launched the first such trial of a 21-year-old Russian soldier, Vadim Shishmarin, who, even though he contended he was following orders, was convicted and sentenced to life in prison for shooting a 62-year-old civilian in the early days of the war. We passed through sandbagged buildings to get to her office. We discussed the links between genocide and the Kremlin propaganda machine, the propaganda machine that effectively attempts to erase Ukrainian identity. Many people I saw in Ukraine told me the soldiers who confronted them had said they were there to denazify their country, to free them from bad Ukrainians in power, to restore their nation to its Russian roots. In Rwanda, a generation ago, a similar tactic was used by the Interahamwe militia, crucial perpetrators of that genocide. Their most effective method was a radio station, Mil Colinas, which repeatedly broadcast that Tutsi people were cockroaches with no right to exist and encouraged their fellow Hutus to kill Tutsis. Russian propaganda started with denazification, then shifted to demonizing Ukrainians, calling for their destruction. One of the propagandists is the pro-Kremlin journalist Timofey Sergeyev, who has rallied for erasing Ukraine's national identity and supports a campaign for the collective punishment of its people. In April, in an op-ed, he wrote that Ukraine must be denazified and Ukrainians made to assimilate the experience of the war as an historical lesson and atonement for their guilt. Jordash's response: I don't think I've seen a representative of the state make a clearer call to attack civilians or a clearer call to genocide in any modern-day conflict. Putin's gruesome playbook. This is my third Vladimir Putin war. The first was the so-called Second Chechen War in 2000. I was there when the capital, Grozny, fell to Russian forces. What I remember most was the frigid, wasted landscape. I also remember the type of fear that freezes your guts to ice. I remember the excruciating sound of Putin's bombs. I remember the smell of gunfire, the constant artillery, the helicopter gunships, and the amount of sticky blood on the floor of the makeshift hospital, a former school where I was sheltering. I remember the screams of soldiers whose limbs were amputated without the benefit of anesthetic. I remember the weariness of people sleepwalking through the streets. I remember cruelty inflicted on civilians who hid in potato shelters, wondering if that night was their last. I remember how frightened I was and how I used the last battery of my satellite phone to report the fall of Grozny to my newspaper back in London before the device died and I was alone. I then sat up with some very young Chechen soldiers trying to teach them rudimentary English. Through our terror and our gloom, we tried to recount bad jokes, to laugh a bit, to eat some hard bread. Outside, it was deep night, lit only by campfires. The boy soldiers told me that by morning, the Russians would enter our village and kill everyone. The tanks were already surrounding us, they said. A commander came in and ordered the boys to prepare to leave just before dawn. They would walk over the mountains to go into hiding. He advised me to come along. But because I did not have a Russian visa, having entered the country illegally through the mountains, I knew that once I was found, I would be executed as a foreign spy. You look like my older sister, one Chechen soldier remarked as he cleaned his Kalashnikov. You should come with us. If the Russians find you, they will just kill you. The soldier and I went for a walk as I made up my mind. We passed the school that had been converted into an ad hoc ward for those who had been injured by mines as they'd retreated from Grozny. The Russians, it turned out, had laid a trap. They told them it was safe to cross the area, a no-man's land. It turned out to have been mined. As a result, the Chechens walked into the trap, and many of them blew up. Some of the soldiers, to reach the end of the field, had to step on the dead bodies to absorb the bomb blast, their winter white uniforms becoming splattered with their comrades' blood. I had been warned by a colleague I had known in Sarajevo, Miguel Gil Moreno de Mora, later killed while reporting the war in Sierra Leone, that the noise of Putin's bombs would drive me to madness. He was right. At times, I thought I was losing my grip on reality. At other times, I thought I would never get out alive. I remember finding solace in prayer, thinking that at least I could die knowing I believed in something. I had witnessed the fall of this place. I had written about it, and I had gotten the word out before the battery of my phone died. But I did not die. I chose not to depart with the soldiers that dawn, taking my chances by staying behind. I escaped in a car driven by a man from Ingushetia. I was wearing Chechen clothes and holding a baby. I remember looking in the rearview mirror to see the Russian tanks, like awful black spiders, rolling into town. The troops would destroy that village, most likely killing the old women with whom I had sheltered in their cellars among the glass pickle jars. My second Putin war was Syria. By the time Putin joined that conflict, in 2015, President Bashar al-Assad had already burned much of his country. But Putin added the finishing touches. He torched East Aleppo. He bombed medical facilities, killing doctors, nurses, and the wounded. He bombed schools and decimated residential areas. At the same time, Russia launched a propaganda war, recruiting troll farms and pro-Assad journalists to attack humanitarians, such as the White Helmets. The team of self-appointed first responders who dug people out from the rubble of the bombs. And now I was in my third Putin war. The Russian troops who arrived in Bucha, however, were of a different generation of soldier than those I met in Chechnya. In Grozny, some of them had been so young that when they'd cried out, they'd yearn for their mothers. These troops could well have been their very sons, maybe their grandsons. Ironically, some were Chechens, known as Kadrovsky, who tend to be loyal to Putin's Chechen puppet, Ramzan Kadyrov. Several Bucha survivors told me that depending on where the soldiers came from in Russia, they could be more cruel or more polite. The ones from Lake Baikal, one woman said, referring to combatants from Siberia, were the most vicious. Others contended that it was the commanders who were savage, while the younger soldiers, as a rule, were civil to the Ukrainians they encountered. Putin has developed a playbook when it comes to wars of aggression. First, long-range artillery, followed by airstrikes that level towns so as to shake the resolve of citizens, followed by on-the-ground attacks on civilians. It's no coincidence that Putin appointed as his Ukraine field commander none other than General Alexander Dvornikov, also known as the Butcher of Syria, who led Russia's operations in that country from 2015 to 2016. As in Syria, Putin's bombardments, sometimes using weapons banned by international treaties, were aimed at soft targets, hospitals, schools, shelters, food supplies. While the Russians destroyed East Aleppo with unguided missiles, cluster munitions, and thermobaric weapons, Ukrainians have not only been hit with that same arsenal, but also with thermite, which is used to melt metal. It was on Dvornikov's watch that the strategic port city of Mariupol was obliterated. By going beyond military targets and training his sights on non-combatants, Putin's calculation has been to slaughter the most vulnerable. These serial attacks on civilians in city after city suggest a blueprint. Suggest Putin and Dvornikov could someday face justice as war criminals. Back to the garden. When I was reporting in Rwanda or Bosnia or the Yazidi ISIS crisis in Iraq, I was not looking at the bigger picture of genocide. In Ukraine, I am. But I also look at the individual pictures that make up the greater whole, because I cannot forget that each of the dead had a richly textured life, a history, foods they loved, sports they were good at. I headed to Bucha on Victory Day, May 9th, the date that marked the celebration of the Soviets winning World War II. In Kyiv, things were tense. Rumors had been circulating that there would be a chemical attack, so people were staying home. May 9th, however, turned out to be rather quiet. When I met Irina Abramova, she was sitting outside at a splintered table, staring off into the distance. She was wearing a blue fleece, a headscarf, her wedding ring. We sat in her aunt's garden because her own house, in which she had spent her entire life, had been blown up 2 months before by a Russian grenade. Nearby was a bed of red tulips, bluebells, daisies, and strawberry plants that rose from the earth. Someone had taken the time to write the names of the plants on little sticks that were inserted in the earth. There was an ashtray with a cigarette butt in it. I asked where it had come from. She shrugged, then said she thought it might have been Oles, her husband of 17 years, who was assassinated a few yards away from her house. Irina told me her story. She would also share aspects of her account, I later discovered, with Ukrainian prosecutors and other journalists. She told me about how she, Ole, and her elderly father, Volodymyr, had been confined to the cellar of her home. Heating potatoes in an electric cooker, how they could hear fierce battles above them. "We weren't very hungry," she said. "We're tired. When you're that frightened, those things don't matter." Tonelessly, Irina gave me details, showing me the pin from the grenade a soldier threw into the door of her home. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.